Thank you so much for listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We are always available online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Allison Stewart. Morning, everybody.
I am Luke Burbank, here to serve your radio and internet needs. Also, coming up, we're going to talk about President Bush's daughter, Jenna, her new book. We're going to talk to somebody who's actually in the demo that this book is aimed at and find out if it's a good book or if it's a little bit underwritten. First, though, let's get the today's top stories from our own Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, everyone. So Pakistan's Supreme Court today has decided that presidential elections in that country can go ahead as scheduled tomorrow, in which current President Pervez Musharraf is expected to be reelected. But the court said a winner can't be announced officially until the court resolves an issue over Musharraf's eligibility. Critics have said he shouldn't be allowed to run for re-election while still holding the post of army chief. Meanwhile, Musharraf and former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto have agreed on a final power-sharing agreement. The plan includes giving amnesty to Benazir Bhutto and other politicians, bankers, and bureaucrats charged with corruption offenses in 1988 through 1999. It was a central demand of Bhutto, who plans to return to Pakistan later this month to run for prime minister. And in Iraq today, U.S. forces reportedly killed at least 24 Shiite militia fighters north of Baghdad. U.S. military officials say the attack was part of an operation targeting a group accused of smuggling weapons from Iran into Iraq. U.S. troops were looking for the commander of a group believed to be associated with the Quds Force. That's an elite branch of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. Now, last month, U.S. congressional leaders pushed to designate that force as a terrorist organization. During the raid today, U.S. aircraft bombed the neighborhood of Halis, and according to reports citing an Iraqi army officer, at least some of those 24 killed were civilians. U.S. military officials said there were no reports of civilian deaths. And in news closer to home, his colleagues in the Senate may want him to slip back into the Idaho sunset, but Senator Larry Craig says he's not going anywhere, defying the wishes of many in his Republican Party. Yesterday, the embattled lawmaker from Idaho said he would stay in his Senate seat through next year, despite a court ruling against him in Minnesota. Here's Craig speaking at a press conference in August.
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport. I did nothing wrong, and I regret the decision to plead guilty and the sadness that decision has brought on my wife, my family, friends, staff, and fellow Idahoans. And for that, I apologize.
Yesterday, a judge rejected Craig's request to rescind his guilty plea in connection with an airport sexting case last summer. Previously, Craig had said he would step down from office as a result of the scandal, but yesterday, Craig said, while he was disappointed with the judge's decision, he'll continue to serve as Idaho's senior senator while trying to clear his name. And finally today, giving back gold can't be easy, but that's exactly what former track star Marion Jones will likely have to do. Today, the Olympic gold-winning athlete is expected to plead guilty to lying to federal agents about her use of performance-enhancing drugs. The admission would end years of denial and could mean she'd be stripped of the record medal she won in the 2000 Sydney Olympics. The 31-year-old Jones won 3 gold and 2 bronze medals in those games. After the expected plea, Jones would become the first athlete convicted in the cases arising out of the 4-year investigation of the Bay Area Laboratory Cooperative that's fueled a series of steroid scandals in the world of sports. That's the news. It's always online at npr.org. I'm Rachel Martin, Luke and Allison. Back to you.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
You're welcome.
When abstract painter Marla Olmsted of Binghamton, New York was discovered in 2004, she became an overnight sensation. Her painting sold for thousands, tens of thousands of dollars. She had shows in L.A. She appeared on Oprah. Her work was hailed as sophisticated and sensitive. And oh yeah, at the time she was 4 years old. Here's what one collector had to say.
I've been around the block. I've been in and out of art and galleries and stuff all my life. And I have never seen one little person affect the art community and people around the world as much as this little girl has done and continues to do. When I bought the paintings, I knew exactly where they were going to go, and my wife agreed. I knew that this 4-year-old needed to sit right above the Renoir sculpture. So we have the young master and the old master all in the same corner.
Yes, that man has a Renoir in his house.
And apparently someone playing piano in the background all the time.
That's a scene from the documentary My Kid Could Paint That. It traces the rise of four-year-old art media star Marla and how fickle fame can be and how art affects people. The director of that film joins us now, Amir Barlev. Hi, Amir.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great. I'm just going to full disclosure say this. I really liked your movie just before I even start this interview. I found it really interesting. But one of the things I found interesting about it was you went in to make one kind of movie and you ended up making a different movie. Tell people about your original intention, the original documentary you expected to make.
Well, the original documentary that I thought I was making was about this wild ride that this four-year-old and her family were going to take. They weren't the type of people that I expected to meet when I heard about a four-year-old celebrity. They were very, her parents were very ambivalent about all the attention they were getting, very likable. And here they had literally overnight become international stars in a world they knew nothing about, the world of abstract art. They were written about in as far away as Pakistan and Chile and on news in Tokyo and Russia. And, you know, to me, it was a very cinematic story about somebody who had just won the lottery. And, of course, you know, if she had been a chess prodigy, there's these objective standards that would have come to bear where we can say, well, look, the kid's beating adults in chess. But because it was abstract art that people were saying she was prodigious in, it brings up a bunch of interesting issues about how we value art.
And how we value artists. It's interesting in the film, people assign all these sort of characteristics and beliefs about this little girl. Tell me about what you observed about the way these collectors reacted to Marla.
I think in a lot of ways it wasn't about the art she was making so much as it was about a sense that people were buying a piece of childhood. You know, in the film, you see people move to tears when they talk about her. And there was this sense that because she was so young, she hadn't yet been corrupted by the things that corrupt the rest of us as we get older. So that's why people were buying her art. And then other people who were interested in Marla Olmsted, but not necessarily spending $25,000 for her paintings, I think they were interested in it for the same reason that people are curious about chimps and elephants when they paint. We all have this kind of, a lot of people have these questions about how we value art and what does it mean when two paintings that look very similar on one level are valued very differently, such as a child's painting versus a Jackson Pollock.
So that would have been the original movie you made, and then halfway through the filming of this movie, you've been involved with this family, filming their breakfasts and getting up and all this kind of stuff and following them around on their media appearances. Marla was getting all this publicity, and you sat down with the family. She'd been featured on 60 Minutes 2. She'd done an interview with 60 Minutes 2, and then the show aired. Let's play a little bit of this clip, which changed everything.
I saw no evidence that she was a child prodigy in painting. I saw a normal, charming, adorable child painting the way preschool children paint, except that she had a coach who kept her going.
That coach is Marla's father, who's often present when Marla paints. He can be heard on this tape directing her, sometimes sternly.
Paint the red. Paint the red. Driving me crazy. Paint the red.
So that was Charlie Rose reporting on 60 Minutes 2, which cast all this doubt about whether Marla actually painted these artworks on her own. Did that just completely come out of the blue?
Well, it certainly did for me.
Yeah. You never had doubt?
I had no doubts. I had no reason to doubt. And you know, even after I watched that, the idea that her parents would be behind this grand art hoax just didn't at all jibe with my sense of them. And so what happened was they stopped doing all media. They felt burned, but they turned to my documentary to exonerate them.
And that put you in a really weird
position. The second half of the film picks up, and that's how I kind of got dragged into my own story in a way.
Yeah, you got put in a really weird position because you had to document what's happening, yet you really wanted to be truthful with this family that you had started to have your own doubts. One of the reasons is they can never really get Marla on film. No one could get her painting the kind of paintings which sold for the most and seemed the most mature, right?
It's as much a film about cameras as it is about paintbrushes, I think. And in fact, in some ways, I see this as a kind of an allegory that touches on all kinds of things like reality TV and television and all these things. You know, we became dependent on the camera in this situation to clear this family's name. And as you said, you know, the camera affects what it tries to capture often. And these complicated relationships develop between journalists and their subjects when sometimes we need to represent people in a way that they don't want to be represented.
Have the Olmsteads,
you know, the left-hand turn that the film takes unexpectedly midway, the world that had put this little girl up on this pedestal, you know, bursting into tears when they talked about her and calling her the next Picasso, just literally in the space of the 7 minutes of that expose, turned right around and considered the family criminals, the whole thing a hoax. They were, in a way, they were almost run out of town. They were getting all this vitriolic hate email. I think really what the film is about is in some ways our incapacity to live in the sort of middle ground where most things happen, between hoax and genius.
So a question for you. I know that I read in one interview the Olmsteads have seen the film and they're not particularly happy with it. Do you think Marla had assistance with painting her paintings?
Well, you know, what I think is presented at the end of the film in a pretty climactic scene.
You sly dog.
Well, I
don't
want to
give away
the movie. It's opening up today.
Good point.
I want your listeners to go out and see for themselves. I mean, what I can say about this is that this is a true mystery, and there's not one scenario that's ever really truly added up for me to this day.
That's interesting.
I have my gut feelings, and audience members are going to need to see the film and decide for themselves whether or not they disagree with me.
All right. Well, we're going to check back with you around award season, because I'm predicting that you're going to have a good award season with this film. It's called My Kid Could Paint
That's
That.
Very kind of you.
Amir Bar-Lev, the director of the documentary from Sony Pictures Classics. It's in theaters today. Thanks for spending some time with us at the Bryant Park Project.
Thanks for having me.